Hi, I'm Michael. Welcome to Beyond the Screenplay, the podcast where each episode we do a conversational deep dive analysis into a film. Today, we are talking about Dune Part 2, directed by Denis Villeneuve, written by Denis Villeneuve and John Spates, based on the book Dune by Frank Herbert. I'm joined by the Beyond the Screenplay team, Trisha Arand.
Hello, everyone.
Brian Bittner.
Hello, hello.
And Alex Calleros.
Hi.
Okay, so before we get into it, we're in week six of our Best Picture winter season. Last week, we talked about Past Lives, which is very exciting. Next week, we're going to be back talking about Fargo, which is going to be a lot of fun. And we also recently concluded our What We're Watching Patreon exclusive series, where we watched all six episodes of True Detective Night Country and shared all of our thoughts there. And oh, did we have thoughts? So if you want to hear those thoughts, if you have thoughts on those that show as well, all that is over on the Beyond Screenplay Patreon. Link is in the show notes. Okay, so we're here. Dune Part 2. It happened.
It finally came out.
And so I do not feel about any other movies the way I feel about these Dune films. And I thought maybe the first one was an aberration and that the second one would solidify it, but it didn't, where I feel like I'm this quantum state of a movie watcher when I'm watching Dune. And on one side of me, I'm sort of like, is this good? Or is this kind of annoying? Like, okay, get over yourself. Like, oh my God. Like, what time is it? Is it time to go? That's a true feeling that I'm having on one lane. And then right next to it, simultaneously, I'm like, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. I am so in it. Like, give it to me. I just want to be here for forever. And I'm like, at any given moment, it's like my superposition collapses into one of those things. And it's a very strange experience for me. So I'm still wrestling with that, where like I left the theater and was sort of having this thought of like, why did I feel like things were rushed in a 2 hour and 40 minute movie? Like, where's some weird structural things going on? And then I'm also like, I miss it. I want to go back. Why am I not there right now? So I'm really excited to talk about this movie and kind of like pull it apart and see if there are any answers to be found about what this movie does to me. But it definitely does something. So kudos to it on that. So that's where I'm starting. Alex, the people want to know, how did you feel about Dune Part 2?
The guy who's been, every time we say Dune Part 2 in this podcast, goes, yes, it's coming. Yeah, I mean, so for some context, if you haven't heard me already talk about this a million times, Dune Part 1 was one of my favorite theater experiences in a long time, like kind of almost since like Lord of the Rings, maybe. Just seeing it in like a true IMAX screen after a couple of margaritas opening night, it was just like transcendent. And it was an experience movie in a way that I rarely get. Like I felt so immersed in a way that brought me back to childhood, that childhood complete immersion in a story world. And so I just had such a fondness for the first part of this franchise because of that experience and repeat experiences going back and being able to re-tap into that immersion. And so this movie was interesting because it has a very different pace. It has a very different vibe in some ways. It's still very much Dune, still very much Denis Villeneuve, but you know, the kind of nature, spirituality, flow, elegance of the first film, which is so much of what I tapped into, is kind of put to the side here in favor of this really almost like metal energy, like really driving, really intense, kind of dark, you know, the whole Harkonnen sequence, which is awesome. You know, it feels like this movie is much more operating in this kind of like metal driving Christopher Nolan. We don't really ever stop. Everything's kind of the same length as we cut through the scenes. And it's not as annoying to me as like a Christopher Nolan modern day film where everything's like a literal montage. Like, this movie still has scenes and pauses, but there weren't the same dynamics and the same kind of like letting things sit, letting things sink in as part one had. And I think a lot of people watch part one like on HBO Max at the time, because it came out on streaming day and date with theaters. And a lot of people, I think, only saw it that way and were like, oh, it's a little slow. It's a little boring. It's, you know, nothing happened. And I'm like, no, you don't get it. If you saw it in IMAX, it's not about what happens. It's about the experience. And it almost felt like this movie like overcorrected in a way and like tried to make a lot of things happen. And I didn't feel like I got to sit in the moments the way I wanted to really feel them and have them like land. So I feel very conflicted about Dune Part 2 because of this. On the one hand, it already has introduced so much to the universe, things that, you know, from the wider world of the universe that it was really exciting to see. There's already, you know, I kept forgetting that, you know, Zendaya in the first movie, like, doesn't speak basically, except for like the very end. She's just like in a perfume commercial. It's like, oh, like Chani's a character. And now I can't imagine her not being a character, you know? So there's so many things in this movie, almost like Empire Strikes Back, where it's like, you think back on Star Wars and it's like, oh wait, that wasn't in the first movie. That was after the first movie. So I can already sense the story world has gotten bigger in a way that I like, and I'm happy to have all these things. And yet I also feel sad because the part one energy that I so dug isn't here as much. But we can get into like, also Empire Strikes Back isn't actually my favorite of the Star Wars movies, if I'm being honest. Two Towers probably isn't my favorite of the Lord of the Rings movies, if I'm being honest. So it might also be like a middle chapter thing happening here, because I think this is very much a middle chapter in a way that I also did not expect and was not prepared for.
Yeah, we'll get into that for sure.
Lots to talk about in conclusion.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Part two is expectation sequels. Like, yeah, I think all of that. This is, you know, ripe for that kind of conversation. Okay. Well, Trisha, what did you think? I feel like I have a little bit of a read from the body language. Trisha and I saw it together. So we were sitting next to each other. What are your thoughts on Dune Part Two?
I have so much to say. Overall, I would say I liked this experience of watching it a lot better than I liked watching Dune Part 1. Now, keep in mind, I am one of those people that only saw it on HBO Max and on my tiny television. And I swore up and down on the podcast that I was going to go out and see it in the theater immediately as soon as I could so I could have the theater experience. And did I do that? Oh, no, I did not. So I didn't have like sky high hopes for this. I enjoyed my time watching the first part. I thought it was visually spectacular, but I thought it had some story problems. We did a whole show about it. You can listen to it. But I was just kind of like, okay, Dune. All right, Dune. Yeah, sure. Well, okay, sure. Fine. That'll be fine. And then I went and saw it in the big, big room with all the speakers. And it shook my chair so much. It blasted me into my seat. And it was like being on a theme park ride. Who was I talking to today? But somebody was saying like, I don't know, it all felt kind of fast and silly. And I was like, yeah, that's what a theme park ride is. It's fast and silly. And also the thrill of a lifetime. And I kind of felt that way watching this. Overall, it checks a few of my boxes that the first one didn't check. Like, there's a lot more thematic content here. Like, this movie, for the problems I do think it has a lot more theme to it. Like, people are talking about things, and there's a character arc. Paul starts the story in one place. He ends up somewhere totally different. And there's a little bit more of, like, an actual journey for the character where his choices are affecting what's happening. And he even has a goal, like near the beginning of the movie, he like says a goal to his mom where he's like, I got to get close to the emperor. So I'm going to use this, you know, this messiah myth to do that, to achieve my goal. And so just some of those things that I felt the first movie didn't have, like an engine and a theme, I was like, this is here. Okay, I've got it. I also have read the book. So some of the things that probably bump for other people didn't bump for me. I knew from like 10, 15 minutes into this, we weren't going to, you know, wrap up the whole story. It felt like too much was happening. And even though we've roughly ended at the place where the first book ends, whole storylines had to be sacrificed for that to happen. And so I kind of sensed that from the outset, and also sensed that Villeneuve was aiming to make a third movie and that we would be, he would leave us some cliffhangers. So that didn't bump for me or bother me at all. And then, you know, some other things, like, I think there's some really jarring sequences in this where, like, the movie doesn't tell you where we are, what's going on, why. Mm-hmm. Like, here's Léa Seydoux. We're, this guy's fighting that guy in this arena. And meanwhile, we're out here. They're harvesting spice. And we have, why are we here? We're going to sabotage it, I guess. Movie doesn't tell you anything going into that sequence. There's all these things that feel like they're just abutted in this, in the middle act of the movie. But they didn't bother me either because I had read the book. So I think that, you know, overall, I would say my enjoyment was very, very high. And I think it's simply got to be one of the most impressive movies that I've seen in like several years. The feel of like that you described, Michael, I want to go back there. I miss it. Like, I finally feel that for the first time. I didn't feel it in the first movie. And I feel the atmosphere of it now and the texture of it now. And so, yeah, if there was ever a film to make me a believer in IMAX, I guess, and here it is, Dune Part Two.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely want to talk about, as you said, Alex, experience movies, spectacle movies, like what that aspect of film, how do you rate it? And where do you kind of slide the scale of, you know, of story versus spectacle, and when is it okay, and when should we be theoretically upset, and all those things? I definitely want to talk about.
Yeah,
Brian, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, as we've talked about a lot in this podcast, expectation is a hell of a drug. And I mentioned on the part one episode that I went in here having heard it's the first half of a movie, right? And it was just like, great, because it wasn't really announced as that. It was just called Dune, and then you sat down in the theater, it's like Dune part one, like, oh, okay. So when I went to see this, I was expecting the second half of a movie and not episode two of an ongoing series that will continue. You know, it's like, I knew Villeneuve said he wanted to make like a third movie based on Dune Messiah, but I'm like, right, but this is the second half of your original like idea. So like, and granted, it's that that's how the book is, that's how the book is, but this movie feels more like it is setting up the future than closing this two-part chapter, right? Zendaya has that sort of famous line in the first movie. She like looks at camera basically and says, this is only the beginning. And what does she say right before that finale scene? This isn't over yet. It's just like, come on. And it's funny because I saw an article where Villeneuve said he wanted two to be a standalone movie. He wanted it to be like, you could just see it without seeing one, and it just stands. I'm like, I would argue you have to see one and three.
Yeah.
In order to, for this to be, to this movie to work. Cause I feel like, hold on, what's this leading up to? So we'll kind of get into that stuff, like the sort of closing some stuff, but then setting up more stuff. But then the other thing is just these like hot take episodes on super dense movies like Dune or The Batman. Like they're hard, you know? I mean, it's just like someone coming out of Two Towers for the first time, you stick a camera in their face, and you're like, what was your favorite Éomer moment? And they're like, what? Who's that? You know, right? So I was thinking about this movie as I was prepping for the podcast, and I was just like, I remember flashes and impressions. I can barely remember anything that happened. So I went again, and I got back about half an hour ago. I was like, I feel like I can't even talk about this movie. And enjoyed it much more the second time, kind of knowing the wonky structure, knowing that it wasn't going to kind of like, it was going to like start introducing characters halfway through to like just what all the stuff that the movie does. And I was able to just kind of sit back and enjoy it and just like let it all sink in and pay more, a little bit more attention, wrap my head around some of the plot stuff more. I'm still overwhelmed in the second half. So maybe viewing number three will help that. I think as you guys touched on, there's some structure stuff and some dramatic question stuff that is going on here that makes it feel like it's not quite doing movie things in a way that we are used to them happening. But yeah, I'm much more on board with the praise that it's getting. I was kind of like what you were saying, Michael, where I was like looking at comments on posts and some would be like, the best movie I've ever seen. This movie is incredible, like amazing. And then other comments were just like so boring and overwrought. And I'm reading all of them going like, yeah. but yes, second viewing, way more of an enjoyable experience. And I'm very curious to look back on this movie in the future once like the show comes out and the third movie comes out and that kind of stuff and
there's
sort of see
show?
What this
movie. Oh, no.
But the Bene Gesserit show, which I think could be really fun.
It's called Benny and the Jazz.
No, Brian. Stop it.
But yeah, to see what this movie is doing in the bigger picture thing. But I really felt like this was just going to be the second half of a story. And that was going to like close the door. And then there's room for more stuff. But that's not how it is. So here we are.
Who better to sponsor our season all about elevated cinema than Mubi? Mubi is a curated streaming service dedicated to elevating great cinema from all around the globe. It's for lovers of great cinema and those who don't know they love great cinema yet. From iconic directors to emerging auteurs, there's always something new to discover. And with Mubi, each and every film is hand-selected, so you can explore the best of cinema streaming anytime, anywhere. One such film is High and Low, John Galliano. This gripping and thought-provoking new documentary from Academy Award winner Kevin MacDonald charts the rise and fall story of the fashion designer John Galliano. Galliano was widely recognized as one of the most successful names in 1990s and 2000s couture, until his career abruptly ended when he was caught on camera in 2011, hurling anti-Semitic and racist insults at bystanders in Paris. MacDonald's compelling documentary traces Galliano's working and private life through the decades, candidly investigating his struggles with addiction and the industry pressure he faced along the way. Featuring conversations with Naomi Campbell, Kate Moss, Penelope Cruz, Charlize Theron, Anna Wintour, Edward Enninful, and more. It is in U.S. cinemas starting today, March 8th. And for a limited time, you can try Mubi for free for 30 days at mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay. That's mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay for a whole month of great cinema for free. Thank you to Mubi for sponsoring Beyond the Screenplay. Oh yeah, so tons of things to talk about. Experience movies, part two, part three. The actors are great. I want to talk about the actors. Yeah, mm-hmm.
This cast.
The structure stuff, like all these things. And I want to start with, so for me, I think I'm like you, Trisha. Part two was like much better for me. Like I enjoyed part one. Part two for me had the spectacle and the like, oh my God, so much sand mixed with, oh, but things are happening, like plot is occurring and there's twists and turns. And, you know, we went and saw part one again recently and like going through it again, I was like, oh yeah, like this is amazing, but so little happens, it feels like. Like the Oscar Isaac, you know, what happens to his character feels like the main thing, but it's just kind of like one event, one twist, and the rest feels like a lot of setup. So I was also expecting a more part two. But to me, this did actually feel sort of standalone. Like you do need a lot of the things that are set up in part one. But in terms of a complete arc, this felt more complete and coherent than part one did, certainly. And I think part of my structural issue is that I think the first act, I want to say, like the first hour of this movie, I feel like is paced improperly for a standalone movie, and it's kind of like towing this line of like, we're continuing what you just saw, but we're also sort of setting up the plot arc of this movie. And so there are these sequences that feel really long and kind of like, you know, expositional, establishing the world again. And a part of me is like, well, I already know that, like move along with the plot a little bit. Such that like by the time all the plot stuff is happening, I feel like it's kind of rushed. And Trisha, you were talking about these sequences that the audience kind of feels lost, or it feels like things that are just kind of like, you know, smushed next to each other in an order. And I started to feel that a lot once Paul was embracing the Messiah thing and I gotta go south. And so then it's like in three shots, we sandworm traveled and now he's walking into the room and he's gonna drink the blue stuff and he sees a vision. And then the other thing to lay down more groundwork, the stuff to talk about is I feel like after up to the point that Paul drinks the blue water of life and sees everything, I feel like we're really with Paul and I understand his headspace. After that, I feel like Paul has privileged information of like whatever he sees in that vision changes him and makes him suddenly decide, oh, I have to embrace this Messiah thing. I'm going to use these people. And there's a strange disconnect then that happens for me. And that was really one of the things that felt so strong in the movie is being subjectively with Paul, feeling the tension of not wanting to make a decision that will cost billions of lives. I was on that journey. After that, suddenly I felt detached from him and sort of flailing and ultimately grabbed on to Zendaya. But then her character doesn't get to finish in this movie. And that to me felt like the most, you know, this will continue this later story thing. Right. So it's weird because I feel like in a lot of ways this does feel self-contained to me, but there are these key other elements that are missing that keep it from being completely that. And that's sort of this weird feeling that I get when I'm thinking about the plot of this movie.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, the character of Jamis already is like, we're opening the movie being like, you killed this guy and all the da da da. And it's like, that means nothing as a standalone movie if you haven't just like watched the finale of part one. Yeah. I mean, it's like a corruption arc kind of, you know, it's almost the Michael Corleone, Anakin Skywalker thing. But I agree with you that we are not tracking that over the course of the movie. We're tracking sort of this other arc, which then suddenly like he drinks the Doctor Strange juice and he's like, I've seen all the futures except there's one. And then he's like, and now I am like evil and, you know, not evil, but like, I'm essentially going to become like this sort of tyrant kind of person, you know? And it's like, it's hard to be with him when you haven't tracked that over the course of the entire movie. And instead it just sort of happens really quickly, like you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking about the Lord of the Rings comparisons. Cause I do think that there is something there. Like this movie is really nerdy. The book is really nerdy. There's a density to it. And I mentioned this before where it's all very dense and kind of dry and kind of intellectual and, in a very Tolkien-esque kind of a way, right? Where like there's a bunch of linguistic stuff in here. There's truly like 8 languages in here that you're kind of supposed to be tracking with about different stuff. And Paul truly has like 8 names. And it's so exhausting, with everybody calling him all of his names all the time. And yeah, anyway, but there are those, like environmental things, but the thing that Lord of the Rings has that Dune has never had is like essentially a clear trajectory or like goal.
One big dramatic question over the entire
A big dramatic question. Yeah. And when I rewatched Dune Part 1, I was missing it. Like deeply, like think about Fellowship of the Ring, take the ring from here to Mordor, drop it in the fire. That's the whole thing. And that buys you like the simplicity of that, as we've talked about many times, buys you 8 languages and 9 central characters and like all of the different rules and magic and things that you want to do. And Dune doesn't have that until Paul says he wants to get close to the Emperor so he can avenge his father, or basically like take out the Emperor because he thinks the Emperor killed his father. Whatever, great, fine. But that's a goal. I was tracking with it, but there is so much that happens in the movie that has nothing to do with that goal. Like even in Lord of the Rings, because that goal is so clear and so compelling, that you can kind of see how other things fold into it. Like, okay, the hobbits are over here now, then these hobbits are over there. They're trying to get from here to there. There's all of these like plans, but we kind of understand the war. We understand what the war is, who's on which side. And this movie kind of, this story kind of lacks that clarity. And so I really was feeling like I wanted it in this movie, but it was more here than it was in Dune Part 1. And I for that reason, it worked for me. But yeah, then like Josh Brolin's character comes back. He's working for like mercenary, like just
he's a smuggler.
Independent Spice.
Han Solo prototype, yeah. Basically.
Independent Spice doesn't get enough recognition. Sorry.
Well, I wish that they'd even been mentioned, right? Like, oh, there are these like, you know, under black market spice traders over here that are like actually harvesting spice and stealing it and doing whatever. They never even were mentioned at all that those people existed on Arrakis up until then. And so there were things like that where then it eventually is like, oh, Gurney Halleck is back. I kind of see how that can kind of fold into Paul's plan. But again, that contributes, I think, to that lost feeling in the second act. And I agree with you, Michael, that the first act is long is thing number one, but also then doesn't necessarily the transition or the connective tissue doesn't feel all the way like it goes, leads us directly into what happens in the second act. At the worm riding sequence, which is amazing and we need to talk about in detail. But after that, I leaned over to Michael and I was like, is that the midpoint? And he looked at his watch and he goes, nope, that's the end of the first act. And I was like,
no,
oh crap.
I think it's the midpoint, except this movie has a 20-minute spinoff in the middle of it.
Where we go over to Harkonnen or whatever. Yeah,
yeah, because I think this is like a 2-hour and 20-minute movie. I think that's the midpoint of that movie. But then right after that, we peace out for 20 minutes and go hang out with other people. Then we check in with Josh Brolin and then we get back into the story. Because I think the end of Act One is that montage where he gets his name and then they kind of go into you know, now we're hanging out together and we're like fighting people and we're doing all this stuff. And then I think that's the midpoint, but it's 1 hour and 10 minutes into a 2-hour and 40-minute movie because this movie is structurally weird. Right. That's my thinking.
Interesting.
Hmm. Yeah. It's interesting. Cause you mentioned Trisha, like why have we never heard about smugglers before now, you know? And I think this universe is so rich in that Lord of the Rings, Star Wars, Star Trek way, but it's being interpreted and put to film by this director, Denis Villeneuve, who kind of, he literally said, you know, and we got this online fervor going that he like doesn't like dialogue, you know, because right. I think there's a little bit of lost in translation there. I mean, what he's saying is, he loves film as just this visual, pure medium. And it comes through in his movies. You know, watch Arrival, you know, like just watch any movie that he kind of pares back on the talkiness of the scripts he's given to really just lean into the audio visual vibe experience. And that is what I love about him as a director. But that can be a challenge when you're also trying to adapt an IP that is this dense and has so much richness in it. You know, I'm reading the book now finally because I want to get all that detail to fill in the blanks, and so it's hard. It's like I want both, because like as I said, I was one of the people who loved the first movie for the vibes, but also this universe is interesting enough that I want to know all the details as well. I do want to know about the things I've heard about, like the navigators that need the spice to make the ships go, and you know, the guilds. There's all these things that they're barely mentioned that are huge parts of the book I've heard. So it's hard. It's like hard. How do you do that? How do you both create this Denis Villeneuve experience movie and yet also give us enough details that the world makes sense and adds up and connects? There probably is no way to do that in 2.5 hours. But a part of me just wanted to, like, you know what, if this is the new Lord of the Rings, all of those movies were like 3 hours or more, you know, and maybe it's okay for these movies to be 3 hours and just give me 15 more minutes to like let things land or to explain a bit more. Or I mean, there are whole actors that are not in this movie that shot scenes. Tim Blake Nelson was cut out of this movie.
How dare.
The guy, what's his name, who played Thufir Hawat in the first movie.
Stephen McKinley Henderson.
Like everybody, we all love him whenever we see him. Like he was supposed to be in this movie, you know? And so there was a lot on the cutting room floor here. And I don't know. I don't know if that was all Denis Villeneuve's choice to kind of trim it down and give it this pace. But I would have preferred the big extended cut version. Honestly, if we're going to do this for 2 hours and 45 minutes anyway, I'll stick around for another 15, 20 minutes to get more out of this world and maybe fix some pacing problems.
Yeah, it's I heard a couple of people say it's too short and too long. And I feel like it's that thing of like there. I agree with you. I like want to know the rules of this world. I want to know all this stuff. I want to feel immersed in this world. So I want more of that stuff. But then maybe we're spending too much time on other things, though, like the 20-minute spinoff or whatever, you know, like that kind of stuff where I would like to be like, but just like tell me like who those people are. What are they up to? What do they do? How does like commerce work in this world or whatever, you know?
And or roll it all into a dramatic question that gives the movie momentum so that when you're going to other things and building out the world, it doesn't feel like a detour or like we're looking at our watches or we don't understand the relationship of things. Right. And yeah, that's another. Yeah, it's just a challenge.
The structural thing that's coming to my head is I really liked your comparison, Brian, of The Godfather, right? So if this is a corruption
very Godfather
story, then The Godfather's midpoint is perhaps one of the best, most famous midpoints of all time. And that's exactly at the turning point of, you know, is Michael going to do this or not? He's committed. He's made this new irreversible act. It sends us in a new trajectory. And then the second half of the movie is about dealing with that. And it goes to different places and it sort of, it does what the midpoint is kind of supposed to do, resets the dramatic question a little bit, the staging around it, etc. If Paul writing the sandworm is the midpoint, that's not him making that choice either. Like, I think that's what's so weird structurally is like, that's him kind of being accepted now into...
It's like fully Fremen.
He's the real Fremen.
Right. Yeah. Where like if the midpoint of a, you know, conventional corruption arc is supposed to be that, you know, step of like, oh, you can't take it back now. Now you're going down the dark path.
I killed the women and the children. They're animals.
And I slaughter them. I hate them. That doesn't happen in this movie until it feels like
Act Three.
Act Three, basically. And so that's weird on its own. And I think what's also weird is this being a part two, that it's not happening closer to the beginning of a part two. So if you think about both of these movies back to back to back, the amount of setup for Paul's arc is like 70% of the runtime of these two movies, and then the fallout is the back. And maybe that's the way the book is. You know, I don't know what the constraints are on that. But thinking about something like Spider-Verse, which we talked about, Into the Spider-Verse, that's also being split up into two parts. The end of part one is a great midpoint moment for Miles, you know, to face the sort of the darker side of the truth of this thing that he's gained, and it sets up a whole new question. And so it's just interesting tracking Paul's arc and even tracking like what's going on with the Harkonnens and all this stuff, that despite having 2 hour plus setup for all of this stuff, it feels like then we spent a lot more time setting things up before dominoes start to actually fall.
Yeah, no, it's almost like, you know, there was a choice to cut off this part one, where I think in the book after that fight with Jamis and he goes to be with the Fremen, there's a big time jump. So that would make sense if you were going to do a time jump. But Denis Villeneuve decided not to do a time jump. There's it literally like pick up right where you left off. And part of me wonders, what if you did cram a bit more into, you know, take out some of the vibes of part one, I guess, that I love so much, but got all the way to him riding the sandworm at the end of part one or something, you know, like that's his final test of becoming a Fremen. And then part two picks up there.
And then we have the whole corruption.
Then we have more time of like, I'm a Fremen now, but what am I going to do with this? And so this is also just a choice of where Denis split the book that maybe could be rejiggered. And it's something interesting, too. I think about my favorite way to watch Lord of the Rings now is as a 6-episode limited series where basically I get the extended edition, you know, Blu-rays out and, you know, one disc per night, 6 episodes. And I actually like it better than watching them as 3 movies. And it just feels more right that way. So I'm just curious to see. It might be a while. Denis Villeneuve says he wants to take a break before he does part three, which, you know, is fine. Fair. But I really want the entire experience and to be able to watch it that way and then to judge the story in that other form, because who knows, maybe this these pacing issues, the kind of unevenness we're feeling might play differently as one gigantic experience someday in the future.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because my favorite way to watch the Lord of the Rings trilogy is on a Saturday.
That's my other favorite way to watch it. And I've done it like four times in LA is going to the all day marathon. And it's great because it's, you truly do feel this continuity through the process of like, I began in the Shire and I ended in the Shire, but so much happened and everybody changed. And it's like really special. I want that experience from Dune now that he has teased us with part three. I want that Dune marathon experience.
Right. Well, yeah. Cause I mean, the thing that I'm thinking about, it's like, I feel like we have kind of this like lead up to a midpoint and then the movie's like now 20 minute short film. And then now we're going to kind of do some other weird like pacing things. And then like suddenly take this like character arc in the end. And I was just like, yeah, we are introducing lots of new characters about an hour and 20 minutes into this movie, right? With Austin Butler doing his incredible Stellan Skarsgård impression, which makes me so happy. And I want to see it's every wild. Movie Stellan Skarsgård's ever been in remade with him. But then, you know, we've had Princess Irulan and the Emperor like for a little blip at the beginning, but now we're actually getting to meet them. Now we have surprise Leia Seydoux. And it's just like in a standalone movie, that's really late to be introducing these characters, but also in a two-part movie, that's incredibly late to be introducing these characters. That's like 4 hours into a 5.5 hour thing, right? But as you're saying, Alex, this is the thing, is like, what does Dune look like when it's over, essentially? And then is that like, oh yeah, sure, you introduce these characters in hour four of 15 or whatever, right? It makes perfect sense to, but it feels just really strange as a standalone movie to be introducing people like not even at the beginning of the second act, but kind of like partway into the second act.
Yeah. I will say that for all the structural issues here, I think that thematically some of the choices are really effective for me. Not that I necessarily want to say like, oh, the shape of the movie is doing the theme, because I don't necessarily think that that's true. I kind of think Denis Villeneuve is just doing the best he can, which is to be clear, very impressive with the source material, etc. But I do think that the themes, the way that this movie manages to draw out the themes more into the text and into the plot is really effective. So one of the biggest choices here in the adaptation was to change the character of Chani, essentially, where Chani is not the sort of skeptic that she is in the movie. In the book, she's like a believer in as much as she is like a team member of Paul's, where when he's like on his journey to become the Muad'Dib, she's like with him, supporting him every step of the way in the book. And in the book, when he decides to marry the princess, she's kind of like, sure, cool. That gets you to your goal. It makes no matter to me. And injecting conflict into that relationship is a brilliant adaptation choice, I think, because it draws out the theme of the story, right? Which is like, is he the real prophet? Is he the false prophet? Does it matter if his goal is political and military might? Isn't that kind of evil in and of itself, right? It's really interesting that she's kind of this a religious skeptic. The difference between the northern and the southern tribes, I think, is really well laid out here, where I crystal clear understand everyone in the southern tribes, they're deeply, deeply religious. The northern tribes, they're more metropolitan and they're so worldly, they understand and they live in their cities, right? And they like have these broader views of everything, and so they don't necessarily believe in a messiah at all. And I love all of that stuff that's in the text when they're talking about their names, and he's like what's your secret name? She's like, well, I'll tell you, but he's like, I love that. She's like, I hate it. It's from a dumb old prophecy that I don't believe in. And I want you to call me by the name that I prefer, right? All of that is speaking directly to this theme of using people's faith and their hope, right? Like, an oppressed people have been given hope in the form of like a mythical messiah, myth of the one, you know, the monomyth, as we mentioned when we were talking about Dune Part One. And the harm of harnessing that myth for, yeah, political and military gain and power is deeply disturbing. And having Chani represent like someone that close to Paul in a relationship that the movie is trying, has been trying to sell us on since the previous movie, it's brilliant to make her the, I want to say like the voice of reason, or yeah, the voice of, the real voice of the Fremen, honestly. Like sort of the most pure version of like wanting them to be truly free. They give that role to Chani, and I love it. Mm-hmm.
It's weird that Zendaya is more of an appropriate Dune name than Chani.
Right. No, it's interesting because we have to give the movie credit for being so bold in a lot of ways. You know, it's taking the monomyth. The first movie, you can still buy Paul as a Luke Skywalker kind of character, right, as a Luke who's going to do the honorable thing. He's going to go be a hero for the Fremen. And it really subverts expectations and is very dark, and it has a dark idea about the monomyth, and actually points out that it's a very dangerous myth mixed with politics, mixed with religion. And also, as you're talking about, Trisha, thematically, it is very consistent. Even in the detour scenes when we go to Getty Prime, it's all about the Bene Gesserit, you know, essentially using stories, right, and manipulation, power. You know, it's all about like how people in power manipulate others and use them as pieces on a chessboard. And for a movie, for a franchise that begins in that very Star Wars vibe, very like, you know, the one, the myth, we want to believe in the one, and maybe he is the Kwisatz Haderach, and that sounds kind of cool. But it's actually kind of horrifying, and it's bad, actually. You don't want somebody with that much power, and you don't want people who are religious to put that religious fervor onto that person. It's very dangerous. So, I think it's part of what the movie is kind of unnerving to me, because I think the first movie gave me some of that, like, soul-nourishing, you know, monomyth goodness. And this movie's like, no, we're the Godfather. And we're literally ending on like the Godfather shot of like the partner of the main character being completely disillusioned and horrified by what he's become.
Well, and I'm hardly the first person to say this, but as you probably have read, you can think about Spice as being like faith, essentially, right? Like Spice is like an illusory drug. And like it has sustained the Fremen for however many, you know, thousands of years. And power over spice is power overall, right? Whoever controls the religion controls everything. And right. So, but I feel like I agree with you that the first movie does not fully like crystallize around the sinister nature of the monomyth, whereas this movie really does in a lot of ways. And I agree, even like all the side plots and everybody else's like plots and machinations directly speak to that of here's who's really in charge, or here's who's really winning at the expense of all of these, right, you know, people of faith.
Yeah, even the Harkonnens aren't really winning.
They're not
also pawns in the Bene Gesserit game.
Exactly.
So after we saw the first movie, my partner was like, which came first, Dune or Star Wars? And I said, oh, the book predated Star Wars by about 10 years. She's like, okay, because a lot of similarities there. And I was like, yep, you know, you're just saying spice, faith, the force, faith, right?
Yeah.
And then, of course, second movie, bad guy's your grandfather.
Yeah.
Surprise.
100%. Yeah, Darth Vader's your dad. Yeah. Or grandpa. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Speaking of family lineages, fetus. But Michael, but you're going to say something.
I mean, we could talk about the fetus too. That's, I did think about you a lot, knowing how disturbing the 2001 fetus was and how that has haunted you.
A lot of space fetus in this movie.
An extremely tasteful fetus. I feel like it was done. I said what I said, and I'm going to stick by it.
You're just saying it's not there to look very horrifying, even if it is kind of horrifying in concept.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I feel like a sentient fetus that's literally speaking to you and you just have to mutter to it while you walk around.
Right. Yeah. It's as not creepy as you could possibly make that, which I think is impressive.
Yeah. This movie's handled this sort of like weird hippy dippy Dune stuff in like a really restrained way, where it was sometimes it's just like, here's a shot that has nothing to do with the scene you just watched and nothing to do with the next scene, but like you're just going to look at it for a second and then we're going to keep going. But it's like, as you said, Alex, with the first movie, it just puts you in kind of a state, you know, and it just like makes you feel something and then we move on. Or it's going to be like, yeah, we're not having, you know, in previous adaptations of Dune, like the baby comes out and is like a kid and kills the Baron.
Right.
Like
a toddler kills the Baron Harkonnen.
Right.
Like, yeah.
So like alien. to have Lady Rebecca just like speaking to Lady Jessica. Thank you. Yeah. Lady Rebecca Ferguson. just like speaking to her stomach. And then every once in a while we like cut to a shot of like a CG fetus. Like that's pretty restrained for this franchise.
Well, and that's kind of what I was saying in the last podcast, which is like somehow Denis Villeneuve makes this not goofy.
Right.
Most of the time. Right. Like there is still some goofiness, but he manages to like keep the goofiness to a low roar. Like,
there's a reason these books have been called unadaptable.
Correct.
It's a miracle that he took the source material and make something that feels quite serious the entire time.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, and so I want to talk about the cast really quick, because the cast is immaculate, even like Wes Anderson levels of like, we got Anya Taylor-Joy to come in for a shot. That's what we can do.
I agree with you up until we get to Christopher Walken, but we can circle back to him.
I really like Christopher Walken. I don't know. No. Nope.
There was like one line where he kind of did that, but yeah,
I think he's a great choice for this like wacky Dune stuff. Also, Fatboy Slim video, Weapon of Choice, where he's flying around the mall and then the lyrics are, if you walk without rhythm, you won't attract the worm. It's all like Dune stuff. Yeah.
Oh, that's full interesting. Circle. I realize there. Yeah. I feel like if you would never, if you didn't know Christopher Walken was like Christopher Walken.
No, but I do though.
But I feel like it, I don't know, it totally worked for me.
I thought it worked fine. It wasn't like amazing to me, but I didn't. There's only one moment where his voice did a little Walken-y thing that was took me out of it a bit.
He's in little enough of the movie that in the few scenes he was in, I could just pretend it wasn't him. And I could just look at another part of the screen or just be like, look, he's an old man emperor. It's not Chris Walken. It's not Chris Walken because why would it be?
But, you know, I understand now why they delayed the movie till March, because of the actor strike. Because people have been commenting on, this is like a Mount Rushmore of like who everybody loves right now in Hollywood. Like all the young stars, all the best of the best. Like this is the cast. And it's like it's such an impressive casting feat to both get all these like the hottest like young stars we have, all the way up to older stars that are amazing. All together in one movie, and they all fit their parts more or less. Like it doesn't also feel like they were cast for star power. Like they also naturally slide into these roles, and it's just it's exciting.
Yeah, and I think that's true of Timothée Chalamet and Zendaya too, for being people who like are the like cover of magazine type, like shiny people, you know what I mean? But they're like, and I'm not just like being an old fuddy-duddy where I'm like, I don't like youth as much as like there's like a certain type of young celebrity who's like, look at me, kind of shiny, whatever. But like they're good actors and they fit these roles. Right. And these roles should be a little, you know, as you were saying, Trisha, with Zendaya, like a little bit the audience surrogate kind of thing, you know? And with part one, we talked about Timothée Chalamet kind of being the Mark Hamill or Daniel Radcliffe or Keanu Reeves, where you cast the person who seems a little unequipped for this task. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of watch them grow as an actor over the course of the franchise. And it's like, he is so like wiry that I buy him as like part one Paul, but then he's a strong enough actor that I buy him as this like thing that he becomes in this movie too.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I'd never really seen Zendaya very much, and so it was fun to get to see her in a full movie. And I feel like the role, as you were pointing out, Trisha, you know, Chani being this person that
sees like the truth, like she sees through all of it. Like, I think that's a really important character, as you were saying. I think that's a really good character for like a love interest to play also, right? Like, she sees Paul and this kind of clarity that like some people are persuaded by the Messiah myth, or some people are just like super cynical, not going to buy into it. She kind of can see the whole picture and can reflect back to him like, this is you, this is the true you, and you are going toward it or away from it and different points. And so I think she's great as a someone who like, she's going to turn and scowl and judge and like not buy it, and I believe her, so that when she does like let some of that in, I'm like, okay, if she's okay with it, I feel like I'm okay with it. And Javier Bardem was also very much that for me. Like, almost like it felt weird remembering his character when we meet him in the first movie, because he's so like, I'm giving you nothing, I'm not welcoming.
Right.
And he ends up being such a believer. But because of that setup and because of that performance, it takes me on that journey. I believe that him and these people could be that swept up in this story, and it and all the other performances are also helping this movie not feel goofy, because like they believe
coherent or
and I love that Javier Bardem like has some fun too. Like, there are some funny moments and I was like, that's humor. Wow, you got humor in this in this Dune movie. Well done.
He's truly the Morpheus of this. Like, he's just like watching me. Like, he's the one. He's doing it. He's beginning to believe.
Well, and then Rebecca Ferguson, I mean, she's scared me in this movie. Like, that one shot,
there was where she's like the little smile to the like, I'm gonna kill all of you. Like, that was that was almost favorite Olivia Colman levels. That was pretty cool.
I'm not sure which one you're talking about exactly, but there's a moment where she's kind of sitting in a cave, almost surrounded by other women, and somebody runs in to tell her of the success of Paul writing the Sandworm. And just her eyes, the way she's kind of looking around and, you know, speaking in their language, saying, you must spread the word, whatever. It's like, oh, man, she is bad news. She is scary. Yeah. And I think just Rebecca Ferguson has some presence that works so well for this turn, this like creepy, you know, how do you describe this kind of character? It's like somebody who has lost any morality and is kind of now this like amoral super being that is just like beyond like caring about the little things in life. She's just now this kind of like manipulator above it all alien. And then Paul, that's where the movie you mentioned, Michael, there's that kind of detachment that happens because Paul somewhat joins her in that state. I mean, I guess you drink the worm piss and you become Dr. Manhattan a little bit, which makes sense. Yeah. If the worm piss unlocks, you know, all the past and all like the future for you, then you would be detached from your fellow man because you now understand, you know, all the different possible paths you can go. This one gets you X, Y, and Z. Well, now I'm going to do this in a kind of a fatalistic, deterministic way. And, you know, it's hard to care about things when you're just kind of like deterministically bringing about a future you've already seen.
Yeah. Not to depart too much from the performances, but just thinking again about that scene with the water of life where Paul drinks it. What if that had been the midpoint? Like, what if you did
it? It should have been.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It should have been.
That's the Godfather moment.
Like, do the time jump and then get there and then, okay.
Because that's where I needed more time with the movie, honestly. That's where the movie felt unmoored, because he drank it, and then Chani runs up and she's like, what the hell did you do to him? And then Jessica's like, cry on him right now. And she does it. And you know, that scene, I had to think about it later too. And I was reading online about like, what the hell even happened in that scene? Because she did the tear and a little drop, and then he wakes up. And somebody was actually pointing out, the reason she slaps him there is that, you know, he, as a Bene Gesserit trained person, was maybe just kind of faking the death and like
to like fulfill the prophecy.
The prophecy desert tears will like wake him up. And so he's just now as bad as Jessica, just kind of play acting the prophecy. Jessica, you know, voices Chani into doing the action so that all the people can see. And then he just wakes up for no really good scientific reason, because like, why would more of the worm stuff make you wake up? The movie doesn't get into that clearly, though, and doesn't explore that or like what actually happened there. And then moments later, he's into his like speech about one way forward, and we're like race to the finish. And I just, yeah, I feel like that's where I want that. This is a huge moment for Paul. This is, he's taken this irreversible step. What does it mean? What does it mean for him and Chani? And like, it just, yeah, I want more time there. And I'm sad that the movie was structured how it was, so that it was such a race to the finish after that point.
But I do love Zendaya's performance there. Like,
yes.
Like, that's kind of the moment that sticks with me from the movie in terms of like performance, where it's because it's a character choice and I understand what it means for her, right? She's being unwillingly dragged into this, into this big performance. And she knows what it means for the people that are watching. She knows what it means that she's being forced to do that. And it's a beautiful like acting moment from her, where she also wants the person she loves to wake up. Right. So there are so many layers for her to like work through there when she's like crying, but then upset, and it's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I was thinking this time that I was like, the dramatic question thing we're talking about, the overarching, you know, my friend who I, who Alex and I saw it with, we were talking about goals, stakes, urgency on the way, like on the way home. And just like this movie, it's kind of like not really sure at any given point what is going on, like what people want, why people are doing things. But I do feel like any given scene or sequence, I have a really strong idea of what's going on and what the characters want, what the obstacles are and what the urgency is and everything. So I feel like that is, and that's maybe true of a lot of Villeneuve movies, is like the overarching thing feels a little meandery, but any 5 minutes of it is like incredible. Right. So yeah, that's just an interesting thing to track, but it helps when you just focus on whatever thing you're watching and be like, okay, I know what is going on here. I know what's going on here and now, even if I don't know what this actually has to do yet with the bigger picture.
Yeah. Yeah. And it makes me wonder kind of exactly what you were saying, Brian, is a thought I've been having, is like, it feels like Denis is very good at the scene, the sequence, like constructing it, drawing me in, making me like want to like be part of it. But the overall, like the mastery that I feel and the control, like the hands on the wheel that I get watching those scenes, I don't feel as much when I think about the whole experience. Right. Like, it kind of feels like the movie is maybe driving itself a little bit, because, you know, moment to moment, it's great, but the bigger picture feels maybe less, architected in the same kind of way. And thinking even about, you know, we were talking about all the stuff that got cut from this movie.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's super cool that he's willing to kill his darlings and make cuts like for the better, you know, for the good of the movie. I think Arrival basically was like saved in the edit. It's kind of how it feels when you absorb all of it. And I think that willingness and that discipline is like amazing and should be lauded. Part of me wonders, like, the things that he wants to prioritize keeping in, are those the things that we need for the architecture of the bigger thing? And that's like probably an impossible thing to like know for sure and navigate, but it makes me wonder.
Aliens and The Exorcist, two movies where the theatrical cut got rid of the scene that's where the characters say, this is what the movie's about.
Well, and, you know, he said in interviews that a lot of the scenes he cut had to do with introducing even more characters into the world. You know, I think, probably the characters that were cut were not of the Bene Gesserit prophecy thematic story. You know, they were part of the world, but I think he really trimmed it all the way down to who's involved with this Messiah story, you know, from top to bottom. And that goes all the way up to the Reverend Mother pulling all the strings, all the way down to, you know, the Fremen. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot of discipline in the thematic focus of this movie. But I agree, Michael, I think that is, I love Denis Villeneuve. I wanted to keep making all the movies. I will see anything he makes. But if I have any complaint about most of his films, it is that overall structural flow. And I think, you know, Dune Part One, I love. And then it gets to the like third act, and they're wandering in the desert, and this kind of like underwhelming finale with the knife fight that doesn't have the proper thematic setup, because we learned just right there, you know, Trisha, you pointed this out in our podcast about Dune Part One, just right there, just because like he's never killed a man. And then it's like, oh, okay, so that's what this scene's about. And that's a really big deal, I guess, for him to not kill a man. And like, so what does it mean when he does kill a man? And, you know, the setup wasn't there for that scene to mean something, to be like the finale of a movie. So, yeah, so I agree. It's like Denis is so good at so many things. And I want him to get some help from somebody to like master this last element, because then it would be like, you know, then he is the Muad'Dib. You know, he has all the power.
Well, and even as impressed as I was, or just like, I guess, thankful as I was that this does have a thematic core to it, I do think there could have been more. Like, I do think it could have been clearer. And, you know, I missed the piece that you just said, Alex, where like, we don't know what it means for Paul to kill a man in Dune Part One. In Dune Part One, near the end, when he's like, you know, railing at Lady Jessica, he's like, what did you do to me? You made me a freak. Yes. I saw a vision of a holy war, of people chanting my name and millions of people dead. He seems horrified, but that is not connected to the decisions that Paul makes later in this movie, right? Like, I kind of get there's like a revenge theme in here where he's like, I want to avenge my father, so that's going to make me embrace this thing where I do suddenly not care that millions of people are going to die, which I did seem to really care about before. Think about in Dune Part One, that scene that he has with Oscar Isaac about like, I don't know if I want to be the future of the House of Atreides, right? If Paul isn't sure that he wants that kind of responsibility because he doesn't want to be responsible for people's lives, or he doesn't want to have to wage war against the other houses, if he wants to like live a life of peace and not have to control people, who is Paul? Like, I just want to know where he started, like more clearly. And then the journey becomes more trackable. And then there could be more pieces. Like, I don't want to have to control everybody all the time. If he would say that to Leto at the beginning, like, I don't want to have to deal with all this power, this military might, warring with the Harkonnens, which we've been forever. I don't know if I want to, like, have to always watch my back and fight. And, like, you know, people are trying to assassinate me all the time. I don't want that. Like, all of this violence and conflict, if he wants to opt out of that life, that needs to be more clear at the beginning. And then when he has the vision of like, all these people are dead because of me, that needs to be even more of this inner conflict where it has to be named. What are the paths? This way, when I ascend to my father's like legacy, is death, war, destruction, but a lot of power, right? This way is I like fade into obscurity and like essentially die to that self. I just need that more in the text still. There's so much of it more in Dune Part Two, and I love it. I think it's artfully done. And I know Denis Villeneuve doesn't want to do it in dialogue, but too bad. People have to talk in movies too. And like, if you could, fine, do it as a symbol. He was here flirting with the idea of doing it as a symbol. Here's Leto's ring. I'm going to put it in my jacket for a while, right? That is that same symbol that I'm craving, but the dots aren't all the way connected the way that they could be, right? He puts it in his pocket while he's learning to be a Fremen, and you feel almost the purity of the quest of learning to be a Fremen. But then at some point, he takes it back out, he puts it on, and I'm like, okay, now he's corrupted. But the movie isn't quite doing that work. I'm doing that work. Mm-hmm. And I love that it's in there anyway. But it's still like, for the average moviegoer, it's not all the way there in the way that it could be.
Yeah, you know, Denis Villeneuve, he does leave a lot open to interpretation in these movies. I mean, I think in Dune Part One, there's a lot of scenes where Rebecca Ferguson looks really torn up. She's kind of crying to herself as she's walking somewhere to talk to somebody. And we don't really ever get much clarity on her inner journey in that movie. Like, what does she know at any given point? Has she foreseen things? Is she hiding something? Yeah. You know, it's really all up to us to just like read into it, which can be interesting and like, can be captivating sometimes and other times kind of frustrating. Like, well, I give me a little more of a clue of what I should read into this. And I think about in this movie too, you know, all we see in Paul's vision is that beautiful image of the sand dunes leading to the ocean. And that's where we see Anya Taylor-Joy make her little cameo. And I think how I interpret that is there is a future in which this planet has water. Maybe that's the way through, and that future where this planet has water and the Fremen are free is one way. Every other way, Fremen are oppressed forever and spice is the way of the world or whatever, you know. But the movie, I had to do a lot of that work later, and I wish the movie had given me, because then you feel a bit more with Paul maybe in that post water of life moment. He's saying there's a good thing I'm aiming for, but it's going to be awful for a lot of people. But the people I care about, the Fremen, Chani, like, you know, me and my family, they will survive in this path. And it just, like, he doesn't quite say enough for me to know that there's like any goodness in his path, except for just like enemies all around, one way through. It's so it's like, OK, so you're just kind of evil now. But I think that there's pieces there that I'm putting together myself. And I agree, Trisha, just like a couple more dots would make me a little bit less alienated.
And maybe we'll get a director's cut later. We'll get some deleted scenes or, you know, something that will like sort of help us connect it in sort of a Lord of the Ringsy way. Who knows?
He has claimed he does not do director's cuts.
Right. But also life is long.
And Warner Brothers might have other ideas.
That too.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I think what I would really find interesting is if you made Dune Part One knowing what Dune Part Two was going to be, how would you do it differently? Because my understanding was also that like there was no guarantee that there was going to be a Dune Part Two.
Right.
And it was sort of like as they were finishing up, they were like, oh, this is good. We're going to do more of this. And so if you knew you were going to have 5.5 hours to tell this chunk of story, how might you rearrange it? Is, I think, a really cool experiment to do, and perhaps a profitable one. I don't know. I'm just saying, Denny, call me. Why don't we move to, there's still a lot to talk about. Why don't we move to lessons? So what lessons are we going to take away from Dune Part 2? Brian, what's your lesson?
Yeah, just totally based on what you're just saying there, I was thinking about like why do things sometimes feel like they don't have an ending, or as we talked about in True Detective, why do some things sometimes feel like things aren't happening or whatever, right? And I feel like there is this weird thing happening here where we're just like you said, each of these movies feels like it's being made in a sort of like bigger picture, we're kind of doing a little piece of a bigger puzzle. We don't really know what that puzzle is yet, kind of thing. And I was thinking recently about fractal theory, which we talked about in our Girl with the Dragon Tattoo video and our Silence of the Lambs video, which is if a movie has a three-act structure, so does an act, so does a scene, you know, so any sort of thing that you break down. I'm fascinated by, like, you know, that scene where the good guys win, but like one guy died and they realize after the battle, that guy, like, that's the crisis of the third act. It's not the crisis of the movie, but it's the crisis of the third act. You know, a lot of first acts have an inciting incident where it feels like a mini inciting incident before the main inciting incident of the whole thing. So I'm really fascinated by fractal theory and thinking about like Lord of the Rings, each of those is an act of this big three act story, but then each of those breaks down. Even Alex, the six discs, I bet you could break up like each half of that movie. Well, because the books are told in six parts as well, right? So it's like each of those is kind of its own story. And I feel like a lot of these pre-planned trilogies like Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, you can kind of look at any two movies and be like, oh yeah, there is a complete story here that where like the end of the first movie is the midpoint. But then if you look at it, if you zoom out or zoom in, it kind of structurally all works. And we talked about The Crown, where it feels like each episode is a standalone, complete story. But then if you zoom out, there is a character arc. These are these character arcs that are being told over the course of an entire season. If you zoom way out, there are these character arcs that are happening over the course of the entire six, you know, it's like even just the number six, and there's like two seasons per queen, you know what I mean? Like everything just feels like structurally planned out and perfect. And sometimes that can be boring, right? If you, if just things are like two by the numbers, right? But then we've talked about the Marvel problem of every movie feels like it's, we're not quite done yet. We've got another movie after this one. So like, hang on, because this story's not wrapped up. And there's something here where these Dune movies, they feel complete. They do feel like they have their own little arcs and everything. But then there's something that feels like I'm not getting the sort of beginning, middle, end thing that I want. Like Dune Part 2 feels like it starts as a middle, and then it becomes a beginning for a while where like all the new characters show up, and then it's kind of the middle of that beginning, and then it's like, yeah, and then it's an end. But stay tuned, there's more coming. Zendaya is going to tell you that there's more coming. So yeah, I don't know what it is, and I don't feel like these movies are like adult in terms of that, but I feel like there's something here that I want to keep thinking about, maybe with like Oppenheimer, we can talk about this, like when things feel like they are happening or not happening.
I was thinking about Oppenheimer a lot, actually, and rewatching Oppenheimer, I was thinking about Dune a lot. I think there's some interesting things to compare there.
Right. So not a lesson as much as just something that I've been thinking about a lot and I want to kind of keep digging into, but something to think about. If there is a lesson here in your own writing, think about, like, especially if you're doing something episodic, like does each of your things feel like a complete piece, essentially, you know, that can really have its own beginning, middle, and end. But then also when you zoom out, it feels like you are doing a bigger picture. I love that stuff. I love thinking about that stuff. And I want to see it more when people make these kind of like huge projects like this, like The Crown. Yes.
Yeah, I agree completely, 100%.
Apparently not everything can be The Crown.
Yep.
It's perplexing, but true.
Indeed. Deeply disappointing facet of existence.
Yeah. Or The American Office tells a really amazing, complete story, and then six more seasons happen.
Trisha, what's your lesson?
So... I'm going to talk about the Harkonnens for a second, because they are worse. We've talked a little bit about how if you want your audience to get on board with essentially like a bad protagonist, make your antagonist worse somehow. Because Paul is bad, right? Like House Atreides turns out really bad by the end of this movie, where Paul is just like, okay, I'm going to, you know, basically do fascism my own way with the help of the Fremen, because I'm going to exploit their culture and use that to gain military power. But then the Harkonnens are worse somehow. And, you know, Frank Herbert was great at this. Like, you know, his entire goal in the Dune novels was to interrogate the monomyth and why it has such a powerful hold on our imaginations, particularly in terms of faith and world religion. And part of it is because oppressed people, you know, there's often a big bad, right? And so, like, there's someone to cling to. We're looking for something to cling to in the face of that. And I like the portrayal of the Harkonnens. Like, I think it is very effective at keeping me essentially on board the narrative for most of the time. I would not stay with Paul or any of the rest of the characters the way that I do were it not for the Harkonnens being so very evil. And the design, like, there's production design, there's costume design, there's casting, Austin Butler's whole bit, like a truly believable psychopath. He's doing a great job in that role. Stellan Skarsgård, again, very, very well cast, like bad guys. And it works. It all works really well. And so, yeah, I just think that, like, I think the complex, like, complicated Messiah narrative is actually enriched by having this other side to it of, here are truly bad guys in our narrative. right? Where it's like, we are willing to accept degrees of evil. Mm-hmm. If there are other degrees of evil that we have decided we can't accept. And so it kind of is doing this like deeply psychological thing where it's like, here's our guy. And he is not a good guy, but there's all these people that are worse. And we're going to show them to you in like, here's a large bathtub of black oil and a whole sequence shot on infrared cameras and Austin Butler slashing people's throats for no reason. And like, it's honestly truly comical how much the Harkonnens are just like, I'm going to kill all the people in the room with me for fun because I'm evil. But you're just like, okay, Paul, go get him. Right. By the end of the last sequence. Like, I'm happy that Paul kills Fade Rautha, but also like, I know what the future with Paul as the Muad'Dib means, right? Which is also not great. So I just think that that's, I love the shades of gray here. Like, I think it's working really well. I know I did it. Mm-hmm. I think that the design and the overall everything about the Harkonnens is a key part of the narrative. Mm-hmm. And it's been very well executed here.
Yeah.
Yeah, two thoughts. Yeah, production design in these movies, incredible, like out of this world. The crazy like crescent moon head guys in the arena around them, just like all these like surreal images. I just love it. It's kind of the Geiger-esque, you know, surroundings on Getty Prime.
Florence Pugh's headdresses, can we just talk about
all the headdresses, all the Bene Gesserit, everything. Amazing. Yeah, I love it.
It's like, how did they find the exact like thickness of like, I can see a performance, but also I cannot see anything.
But also chainmail. Like,
how, then, to chainmail.
Yeah, so cool. But also, you were talking about just having the super, super evil Harkonnens, positioning Fade Rautha as the, like, alternative.
Messiah.
Like literally the Bene Gesserit have chosen an alternative. So it's like, if we see the possible futures and it's Paul or this guy, definitely Paul. And it gets into almost a cynical, kind of depressing reality about power, about politics, of just how many times we hear about in politics voting for the lesser of two evils. Just like, there's no good choices. Actually, there's not actually a Luke Skywalker. There's not actually the monomyth hero we want. There's just kind of like politics and power, and usually have to do bad things to get to be in the one or two spots in that game.
Yeah. Yeah, I love how complex all that is. Again, this, I think what I like about Dune Part 2 is it was about something, and I knew what it was about in a way that I'm still quite not sure what a Part 1 was about, because it was a Part 1 in a way that I feel like Part 2 is clearly saying things thematically. Is it weird that I like the Harkonnens? Like, I don't like them, but like, if you had to choose,
delicious.
Like, yeah. I feel like it's like kind of a cool, I don't know, like their vibe is like black and white.
The Barrett.
I was like, gonna say, you just like their aesthetic. That's different than liking the Harkonnens.
Yeah.
To be clear. But I also feel like maybe they like have no, like they know what they have signed up for a little bit. Like, I wonder, I guess that's part of the complexity of the morality one could project is like,
right.
If you know that you're being like
supremely evil.
Evil. Is that better than manipulating people's hope for your like your own?
Right.
And I like that's well, there.
Well, and that's what I actually like about the Bene Gesserit, you know, kind of perspective is like, this guy's a psychopath, but he's controllable. And like, we know he's understandable. We know him, you know. Atreides was getting unpredictable because they lead by the heart and they're kind of, you know, more dangerous in some ways.
Might be slightly good at times.
Right, exactly. Right.
And yeah, on big time scales, the life of an individual matters not, et cetera,
right.
Blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Alex, what's your lesson?
Yeah. I feel like a lot of things we're talking about tie into my lesson, which is, you know, you mentioned, Michael, what is Part 1 about? You know, and I think what is remarkable about Part 1 in hindsight now is how many seeds are planted there. They didn't pay off in that movie, but right from the beginning, these visions Paul is having are horrifying him. And you there's early scenes in part one where the Reverend Mother comes and visits, and her exchange with Lady Jessica, you know, she says, we have other prospects, you know, and she's upset about this candidate even being created because it's in this House Atreides, which they're planning to eliminate because they're kind of out of control. So I think it's just, it's really fun. Once again, I want to watch it all in one sitting in that Lord of the Rings marathon way, because it does feel like, even though these movies were made one at a time, I can tell that Denis Villeneuve did the work to think about what's coming next all the way to part three, because, you mm-hmm. know, the I've heard a lot about this, that Doom Messiah is really what gets into this horror of the monomyth and the kind of dark side of the monomyth in a clearer way than the original book. Part of Frank Herbert's reason for writing Doom Messiah was because people were interpreting the first book as kind of just this wholly positive monomyth story of the young boy
saved growing everyone.
Yeah. Paul's the savior, like taking it as literal as like, oh, it's a good thing. And so I think it's a really clever idea to, instead of just taking the first book in isolation and adapting it as if nothing else came after it, actually looking at the entire Dune canon and figuring out the author's intent that even came after the original text, and then retroactively making it all fit together. So that, you know, that's why I do feel like, yes, every movie they've been saying, we don't know if we're making another one, but it's like, Denis Villeneuve, it really feels like he's intended to make a trilogy this entire time, because so much of what is in these first two movies is like taken from Dune Messiah. And it feels like that's where we've been heading this entire time from the beginning. So I guess that's my lesson, is like, if you're going to adapt material, like a series of books, a series of material, like, it is good to know where you want to end. You know, think about other adaptations like Game of Thrones. They didn't know where they were ending, and then they just kind of winged it, is what it feels like. And it does really feel like he knows where he wants to end with this trilogy. And I am sad we're going to have to wait a while for it, but I'm excited to see if that ending can maybe finally give me the satisfaction I'm missing from these first two movies, because I really do like endings. Like, endings that stick the landing, I really love. Denis Villeneuve is not always great with endings in any of his movies. I think Arrival probably is the one that hits the hardest because of just the emotional power of Arrival's ending. And I have many hopes. I have a lot of hopes for this movie. I still have more hopes for the Dune Part 3, that he can kind of like tie 1 and 2 together and bring it home in a way that, yeah, this movie did not do. I was expecting that from this movie, to be honest, like you, Brian, going in. This was going to be the end of a story. Doom Messiah is like an epilogue or just a kind of a side story. No, that it feels like we're waiting until that movie for this closure. And I need the catharsis, goddammit. So
right.
I really hope we get it.
This is how they control you.
Hope. You're right. It's true. Dude, and just a quick side note. I need to join this Michael Tucker school of not watching trailers, because
I watched it just earlier. I was like,
Yeah, well, the final trailer for this movie is everything.
It's everything.
It's every meaningful moment of this movie. Yeah. I did not watch that one. However, I did watch the first two trailers, and I regret it, because I saw enough images that if I had seen them in the context of the movie, they would have had more power. And but it's just so hard, man, when you're looking forward to a movie this much.
Yep. This is how they enslave us.
But Michael is so rigorous about his trailer avoidance. Like, he's the one literally covering his ears and eyes. And
he did it in the theater for Dune. He did it
making,
in the theater.
Making sounds to himself as a trailer plays so he can't hear the
Harkonnen's
dialogue.
Game power. Just extreme discipline.
Yeah. I need to get some of that for Dune Part 3, because I did rob myself of some of the experience this
We're
time.
We're going to clip this and send it to you in 3 years.
Please. But I love trailers. It's so hard.
The Dune Part 2 has made so much money already. Like, it is doing very, very well.
Yeah.
It seems assured that we will get Dune Part 3. So we will talk again at that time.
No, it's like guaranteed to happen. It's the only person that may delay it is Denis Villeneuve, because he's exhausted doing Dune stuff.
I mean, yes, it does seem very hot.
End your movie in a cliffhanger and then be like, we'll see if I do another one.
I know. It's like, come on, man. Be ready to go if you're going to end it that way.
Yeah.
See, it's weird. I don't know that it's that much of a cliffhanger to me. Like, it feels like it
properly walks both lines to me of like, yeah. This is the end of a story you can project forward enough to understand the meaning. And it could also be setting up a continued thing. But I don't know that like, I need the, more, honestly.
There's like a begin the Clone Wars has line, you know, from Rebecca
Ferguson. Yeah, and look what happened. Like,
anyway. Right, she's got that line, Paul is evil, like Zendaya is miserable. Like, you want that to be the ending of
I mean,
of,
it's, like, it's a Godfather ending.
Right, I feel like thematically, yeah. It's...
Which is not what I want from a Star Wars movie, and it's disturbing and upsetting, but it's really, it is interesting that we got a Godfather.
Right. But again, if we had spent these two movies getting, like, earning that ending, I agree, but it's, right. But it was like, we spent 30 minutes tops kind of being like, this is where this story is going after the last 5 hours.
Yeah. They're an interesting movie pair. I feel like I like going back or picturing myself rewatching these. I'm sort of like, why would I watch part one? Like everything happens in part two, which is just kind of weird, but that kind of takes me into my lesson, which is, so we didn't really talk about the spectacle aspect of film, and
somehow
there's a lot going on these, but I think these are excellent examples of how powerful the spectacle aspect of a movie experience is. And you know, I often try to do this thing where when evaluating how much of an effect something has, you turn the dial down to 0%, see if it makes a difference, turn the dial to 100%, see if it makes a difference. Watching Dune on a screen the size of, you know, your fingernail, it would not be a good experience, right? Like, so you have to have it kind of big enough. Watching it on a screen the size of the Earth where your feet were just a single color, you couldn't tell what's going on. Like, too big, too small. So, like, size obviously matters, right? There's some zone in which we need to comprehend what's happening, obviously. But it's weird to think that, like...
Is that your lesson? Yeah,
where is this going?
I'm so curious.
Are you saying an IMAX screen is a good size for this movie?
Will say, we walked out of Dune Part 2, and we were talking about this very thing, and I said, you know, I was not impressed watching Dune Part 1 on my TV. But think about the first time you saw The Matrix. It was probably, like, on your friend's, like, basement TV, pretty small, right? Like, for a lot of us. And the power of the story was so strong that it didn't matter what screen you were watching it on.
Right.
But we can all agree there are movies you should not watch on a plane. Like, there are movies you should not watch, like, in certain settings. So I think that's where Michael is going with the
Like, continue. Like I said, when we were walking, I was like, if you've only seen Jurassic Park on your phone, have you seen Jurassic Park? Right. So there is some like inextricable aspect of the movie experience that is like spectacle. And I think it's just really interesting, like watching the sliders go back and forth on how big do you need it for it to be spectacle? And what's the trade-off if the on the other side of that is TV shows? So like limited series, like True Detective. I've never seen True Detective in a theater on an IMAX screen, but it was still a cinematic, cool experience for me. Getting to see a story told in this episodic format where you can do the fractal thing that you were talking about, Brian, where you can macro.
He's talking about season one.
I assumed that would go without saying, but it does not.
Only season of True Detective.
Season one of True Detective. Or The Crown or any of these things where like on TV, you can tell these stories that I think Dune honestly would be great at. Like thinking about these things that happen in Dune, seeing it across 4 or 5 hour long episodes, I think would be amazing, but then you don't have the spectacle. And so I think Dune is just a really interesting example to play with those sliders in your brain. And part of me is wondering if we're getting toward a future where the line between TV and cinema is blurring a little bit. Like, is there a world in which you could see a limited series in a theater? Like, is there, you know, will the economics change such that you could have a Dune TV series that you could watch in a theater? Are people's home theaters getting big enough that like that spectacle is there and it's not, it doesn't make, you know, these epic directors vomit to think about them watching on their, oh, you can't watch this movie on, you must see it in IMAX, presented, blah, blah, blah.
Well, you need to watch, if you haven't seen the video of the original Dune director, David Lynch, talking about watching a movie on your iPhone. Just Google that and you'll,
that's great.
You'll thank me later.
And then even things with like VR and Apple Vision Pro, like all these, like the new ways of watching things on big screens at home. Like I'm excited about the future that maybe we're getting into as people are realizing like TV and what it can do for story is amazing, but spectacle is also amazing. Can we keep pushing toward each other in some way? Because I think there's maybe this amazing new middle medium that we're moving toward. And maybe we have to sacrifice billions of people before we get there, but it'll be worth it when we do.
I mean, honestly, if I could, I would pay IMAX all the money to watch like six Dune movies in IMAX that told like the complete story with all the world building and all the characters that had like a better structure. I would pay that money for like 6 years in a row. No problem. You know, like, so if anybody had the stamina or the money or the inclination to do that, like people, I think people would watch an episodic version of this trilogy. No problem. So it's just, yeah, our models don't fit that yet.
Right.
Yeah.
But I want them to. So that's my lesson. Push toward these new models.
Muad'Dib, Michael. Mm-hmm.
There is another. What else have you guys been watching? So next we're going to talk about Fargo. Look forward to that. That's going to be really fun. In the meantime, what have you guys been watching? Trisha, what have you been watching recently?
I wanted to pick something epic in scale to share with you guys. So I've been watching Our Planet 2 on Netflix, which is a nature documentary. It's the second season of that doc on Netflix, of course, with David Attenborough. It's just beautiful, sweeping, like, here's all the animals, here's the earth, and all the things that you don't know are going on our planet. And it's great. It's really great. It has some of the environmental themes of Dune, but with all of the poignancy of being here on our planet. And it will never cease to amaze me how much we can relate to just like a seagull sitting on an island, like waiting for, or an albatross, I guess, is what I'm thinking of. Like, if you've seen it, but there's a whole sequence about albatross, and it's just, we as humans have the capacity to, and the inclination to assign like human drama to everything that goes on this planet. There's this evolutionary ecological mindset that we get into. And so watching this stuff just like is incredible. And it's, you know, filmed in the best possible way it could ever be. It's like so artfully put together, well narrated, feels like this big sweeping story. And strongly recommend Our Planet 2.
I have not seen those, but I will add Planet Earth 3 exists. Yep. And has aired and is absolutely incredible. 97-year-old David Attenborough just walking around doing his thing.
Badass.
Well, yeah. He used to never die.
No. What a hunk.
Protection.
I'm about to die.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would love to talk about these from a storytelling standpoint some point. Ooh. Because there's always a protagonist.
Yep.
And the protagonist is either the predator or the prey, but you are trained to root for them. Mm-hmm. So it's like a little, you know, bird who's trying to run away from a snake. You're like, go bird, go. But then in the next segment, it's like, oh, it's this gator who's trying to kill all these like deer. And you're like, great. All right. Gator's going to like hide and he's going to hide out and then snap. Like, great. That's awesome. So this sort of, as we've talked about with The Killer and Killers of the Flower Moon and Breaking Bad, it's like, we're kind of trained to be like rooting for the protagonist. And we have to like fight for that part of, we have to fight against that part of our brain when the protagonist is like not actually a good person. You're like, oh wait, what do I do?
Or in the case of a nature documentary, not a mammal.
Not right. A, right.
Yeah. Yeah, good point. Mammal.
Yeah.
Right. Mammal.
Silly humans. I mean, and that honestly is like part of the spectacle conversation if we ever have it. But I was thinking about like fireworks shows, things that are pure spectacle, even those have like a shape to them, where you want it kind of to go slow and then it gets a little bit more fun and then it goes away and then it's like big finale. Like there's something, even in pure spectacle, we want some narrative shape. And so again, those sliders are really interesting. Brian, what else have you been watching besides Planet Earth 3?
Well, since it's Oscar weekend, when many of you will be listening to this episode, I wanted to talk about American Fiction, because
right.
Yeah, because I love it. And I, you know, it's nominated for Best Picture. So obviously it's been getting some hype, but I feel like not a lot of people are talking about it. And it's just it's great. It's really smart. It's really funny. It's Jeffrey Wright as a stick in the mud, condescending writer who has contempt for what the masses consider popular. But then no one wants to publish his work because he's not doing like mainstream stuff. Right. So it's very much like an adaptation Charlie versus Donald kind of thing going on in this movie. And Jeffrey Wright, I feel like he's one of those actors who as we talked about in our acting episode, he used to do all these like really different roles, like Basquiat or even the Shaft movie he's incredible in. Like the movie has like a weirdly good cast. But then it's like lately he's just become the sort of scowling, like whether it's Bond or Westworld, he's just like, I'm here to tell you that you shouldn't be here, you know? And he is so three-dimensional in this movie. He plays a character that's sort of like one-dimensional in description, but then he adds so much dimensionality to it in his performance, and it's great. And it's a movie that's like racially smart. Like it's like with Barbie and Poor Things, where we talked about, it's like these movies that are like about the thing, but without being like ham-fisted or saying the thing that we were saying 10 years ago about that thing. It's like, what's mm-hmm. the next part of that conversation? Like Get Out, for instance, like what haven't we really kind of gotten into yet? And then Tracy Ellis Ross is in it. Sterling K. Brown is incredible as always, and Issa Rae, and just like a bunch of other people in the cast. So it's just I really loved it. And if you haven't checked it out yet, it's people are all talking about like the three movies that might win, and then like how much Maestro won't win, and they're not talking about the movies in the middle. So I wanted to shout out American Fiction.
Nice,
cool. All right, Alex, what about you?
I watched a documentary called Grounded 2, The Making of Last of Us Part 2.
Oh. Yeah.
And PlayStation, Sony is known for kind of randomly making really good documentaries about their games. And so this is a documentary about the developer Naughty Dog creating The Last of Us Part 2, the game. And it's a really, all these documentaries were so interesting to me, even before I was working in games. Just as a filmmaker, as a creator, just watching people put everything into a massive project, and all these documentaries kind of go through the process of like revealing trailers, games to the public, and seeing the reaction of the public and the pressure and the excitement. And as a creator, I have an emotional journey on these documentaries with like empathy with the people making them. And then this gets into like the horror too of like toxic fandom and mm-hmm. like people like threatening your life because of, you know, a story choice or, you know, a thing your character did, but you as an actor are now like your family's being threatened. And so it's a really interesting look at just like the moment we're in with like media and fandom and the internet and how people consume things and take things way too far. And also just, yeah, the creative journey and also the video game industry and, you know, how do we like do this sustainably? Because these projects are so massive and so overwhelming. It's just like, can we keep doing this even? Mm. So yeah, Grounded 2, very interesting free documentary on YouTube.
Nice.
Yeah, it's great. And one of the smartest things they do is they have a little graphic at the bottom of the screen that's like, here's what month and year it is, and here's the month and year the game is going to come out.
Oh, nice.
But it's when the game is going to come out as of that time in the documentary. So you watch the graphics start to go, nope, maybe another. So you get to like the pain of the delays and the choices they have to make and, you know, for the greater good and everything. Yeah, it's great.
That's cool.
It's like Hearts of Darkness, but for video games.
yeah,
totally.
Michael, what have you been watching?
Yeah, so I was trying to decide if I wanted to like say something smart or say what I've actually been watching. And I'm going to say I've actually been watching. I've been watching Community again, the TV show.
Yeah.
Which I watched once and adored after hearing people tell me like, you would love it, like you would love it. I watched it and I loved it. And then it got kind of bad toward the end. It felt different. And so I ended up not finishing it. So this time I watched it all again and went all the way through the finish and really enjoyed it. I appreciate it even more watching it again. It's a fascinating meta
taking that perspective, watching it, knowing kind of where things end up and kind of the drama behind the scenes, the show starts in a very, it seems like it thinks it's going to be a normal sitcom where it's like, I'm like the guy and I don't want to be at this community college, but like, cause I'm too cool and I'm a lawyer, but I'm here and I'm going to like, you know, manipulate people and like, who's that hot girl? I want to like hang out with her. And oh no, now I've accidentally created the study group. And like all the leads and all the roles that you think the sitcom formula should go into, they all like fall apart. It almost feels like the writers realized that would be so much fun to just put those two together, do this thing. And you can just feel the fun coming out of like the creators as you're watching the show. So anyway, it's really fun. If you're a movie nerd, there's so many movie references in it. So like they do an entire episode based on Hearts of Darkness. And I was like, wait, most people have not seen the documentary about the making of Apocalypse Now to understand any of these jokes, but I do. And this is wonderful. So it's been really fun to rewatch, go through the whole thing. And then, you know, six seasons and a movie is coming. They're going to start shooting it soon. So I'm just nerding out and on like the subreddit for Community now. Like I'm a hardcore Community fan is what I'm revealing to you guys. So
nice. One of my favorite like Hollywood, and I have to be like slightly name droppy stories, is my buddy Kunal moved here and did a play in the middle of nowhere, LA. And it was him and this one other actor, Danny Pudi. And I went and saw the play and hung out with them and everything. And then like a few months later, they both got a pilot. And it's like, oh, great. Great. Let's see what happens. Let's see if it gets picked up. And those pilots were The Big Bang Theory and Community. It's just like, well, they did okay.
Yeah. It also has made me appreciate Alison Brie even more, who I feel like was already underrated, but like I think she's even underrated in how underrated she is. Like Alison Brie is really funny and really good. She was on Mad Men and Community at the same time. Like she's really, really talented.
Somehow playing like characters like who feel like they're 15 years apart in age, right? Just because of the way she plays them.
Totally. Yes. Really good. Anyway. Yeah. All right. Well, we've talked about Dune. It happened.
Not for the last time.
Probably not for the last time.
This isn't over yet.
The holy war begins.
I wonder
what's happening, mother.
We're gonna hear a lot more from Anya Taylor-Joy. Question marks.
So like they cast her now, but like not that much time can pass because we're not gonna wait for like Paul to be 20 years older, right?
Maybe. And like why not?
Find out.
Yeah.
I can't imagine Denis wanting to use like de-aging or up-aging on anybody because he hates CG. Who knows?
I mean, if he takes a break for a couple of years and then they start pre-production, like it might be another 6 years, 6 or 7 years, and everyone.
I'm just saying, can you bridge like Timothy Chalamet? Like, can you bridge him being like 20 years older, believably, than
in 6 years? AI will just be making everything anyway. He'll just type in Dune Part 3 and hit generate, and it'll look amazing. So. We want to say a big thank you, as always, to the patrons that make this show possible. Thank you very much for supporting us. And if you want to help us make more episodes, head over to the Beyond Screenplay Patreon. We have lots of perks, like several Patreon exclusive episodes. Fargo is going to be one. Is that true?
Yeah.
So next week, if you want to hear us talk about Fargo, that will be available on the Beyond Screenplay Patreon. It's also where our thoughts on True Detective Night Country live. Lots of fun things over there. Thank you to our producer, Vince Major. Thank you to our editors, Donovan Bullen, Caleb Berg, and Jose Gomez. I'm Michael Tucker, and I'm joined today by Trisha Rand, Brian Bittner, and Alex Calleros. All of our Twitter handles are in the show notes. Send us a tweet and say hi, and we will see you in the next episode for our discussion of Fargo.
Bye, everybody.
May thy knife chip and shatter.
Bye-bye.